Hugh, sleigh bells, red nose, hooves. Clip clop, clip clop, clip clop. It's time for the special Christmas edition of the Linux Boys podcast, which isn't actually Christmas themed at all. Just a coincidence, really. But hey, let's plow on and make Christmas great again. I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Ben Everard.
I'm Graham Morrison.
And I'm Mike Saunders.
And in this, which is season 4, episode 19, amazingly, of Linux Voice, we have still to come news. We have the 3/4 of the way reminder. We have finds of the fortnight. We have our neurons and the voice of the masses. If you want more in paper-based format, you can go to the shelves of any good newsagent and buy a Linux magazine. Or you can subscribe at www.linux-magazine.com. Oh, yes, where in the very pages of that magazine, you will still find us, our happy, smiling faces, some would say a grotesque parody of our actual faces, which are not normally happy or smiling, but they are for the purposes of the magazine. And smug. They are now, actually.
Everyone used to say I look smug.
Yeah, Graham looks smug. Actually, I am in quite a good mood today, because it's getting a bit festive, and I believe there's some good news in the news.
There is good news in the news. Does that bring us swiftly on to the good news in the news? Yes. It's a whole plethora of good news, and I don't know what to pick first. Let's start with EU news from the other side of the channel. Well, currently this side of the channel as well. Both sides of the channel. The EU has launched a bug bounty. So they've got a 1.9 million euros, which is about 1.9 million pounds. For those of us in the UK,
I refuse to be in the UK. Come on, it's the last one of the year.
Okay, Loretta.
For those of us in the UK or a little corner of Wiltshire that will be forever France. So it's 1.9 million euros that's going towards free software audit and a bug bounty. The free software audit, something they've been doing for a little while, and basically pay people who know what they're doing to poke around in the internals of security critical bits of free software, find out what's going on, and hopefully make them more secure. The bug bounties are new bits, so if you're in the EU and you fancy poking around at stuff, trying to break it in the hope of possibly making a few quid, or even if you don't make a few quid, making the world a slightly safer place, then this is for you.
That's cool. Is 1.9 million euros a lot of money?
It was six months ago.
In the scale of bug bounties and such like?
I mean, I'm sure... Actually, I don't know how big it is compared to things like Google and whatnot. Certainly in terms of free software bug bounties, it's big. The big companies may well pay more. I don't really know how much any of the big companies pay. I don't know if they make it publicly known. I have no idea. It's a simple answer.
Okay.
If you got paid it for one bug, you'd think it was pretty big. If it was paid over 1.9 million bugs, you'd think it was pretty small.
That's true. How long is a piece of buggy string?
Indeed. Right, let's move back into the Linux-specific world next. And that is that Dev1, the fork of Debian with systemd forcibly removed and slung out of the window, has hit beta 2 of its Jesse release. This is available on all sorts of things, from the Raspberry Pi to your PC to your cloud server. You can download, install Dev1, and live life blissfully free of systemd, should you wish to. It's one of those things. I actually quite like systemd now, but yeah, I still quite like the fact that there's a few people stamping their feet and refusing to use it. I don't know why I quite like it, but I do. Actually, I'll tell you what it is. I like the fact that you can. It's the world has moved on, and some people always refuse to move with it. And that's part of what makes the world a more colourful place. It's not necessarily a sensible thing to do. The sensible thing is almost certainly just to learn to use System D. It's pretty functional. It does a lot of good things. It does some things quite a bit better than Sysphere Knit did. But some people will refuse to move on, and there's a place for them, and that's nice.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people never thought that DevOne would actually go this far. I think, you know, even we at the time just assumed that it would be a fad and it would die out quickly. So how many are we, a year, 2 years later, 2 years into this project now, and, you know, they're still surviving. So I'll give them credit for that.
Ben, you make it sound like DevOne is the really rough pub in town where all the rough folks go, and it's good that it's there to just keep them happy in their own little cluster.
See, I view it a little bit like people who still use an Amiga. Its day has passed, but you know what? Go ahead, keep using it and have fun.
God, saying that the Amiga's day has passed. Didn't we talk about last episode that Amiga OS 3.10 had an update after 25 years? I mean, you know, that's a living project.
Can it even connect to the internet?
Of course, yeah. Yeah, you have to, like, buy a separate TCP IP stack, but that's like with all good operating systems.
Slightly less powerful than the average light bulb these days. You can keep using it if you wish to.
Do you happen to know if they include Pulse Audio? Because they might have me then.
I haven't checked, actually.
At least you can actually remove Pulse Audio, you know, just a couple of dependencies.
Just unplug your headphone jack and it's gone. Let's look at more almost new release news, and that is that Wine, the famous not an emulator of Windows, is almost released version 2. It's on the release candidate now. And so if you don't know what Wine is, it basically allows you to run Windows software without running Windows. So you can do it inside Linux. It's used quite a bit in porting games over to Linux. You can sort of wrap them in Wine and sort of push it out the door with varying success.
That sounds good, being wrapped in Wine.
Indeed.
I've actually used Wine recently to try and get... I've got a pretty generic water cooler that uses some... On Windows, it uses some proprietary software to manage the fans on the water cooler. It's Corsair Link, it's called.
A cooling, water cooling PC thing.
Yeah, that's
not
right.
Not something for chilling
yeah,
water.
Yeah, sorry, I missed that very important piece of information out. Yeah. So, yeah, in my PC, my CPU is cooled by a radiator, basically, with water circulating from it. And the piece of software called Corsair Link had actually been reverse engineered by a load of people. And there was a Linux version, but... Unfortunately, the very latest versions of the hardware use a different embedded chip and have totally messed up the protocol, so you can no longer use the open source version. So I did try using Corsair Link through Wine. It didn't work, and I haven't had much success with Wine over recent... And the very few times that I've tried to use it, I don't know if that's indicative of anything. Maybe the fact that it isn't so important anymore to try and get a few Windows apps running, but... it's still a great project.
Yeah, it can be an absolute pig to configure.
Yeah.
It would have been surprising. Well, I would have found it surprising if it had worked on something that runs at such a low level.
Well, that's true. And the controller itself, it connects to an internal USB port. So in theory, you know, the USB's kind of hit and miss as well. I mean, it'd be much better off using a virtual machine. But I thought I'd try it because I wasn't too fussed about it. But, it's just such a pity that Corsair can't just bloody release the protocol, for God's sake. It's like, how difficult can it be?
It's not like anyone's going to rip it off.
No. I mean, what secret proprietary details are they hiding about their, you know, temperature and fan pulse width modulation. I don't know. But yeah, two. I mean, that's a must be a landmark.
Yeah, I mean, I had a look in the release notes, and there was nothing sort of outstanding about it. I mean, there was just, you know, the thing with something like Wine is that they very rarely have sort of big features. It's just here's a load of bug fixes, and everything gets a little bit better. And it's that sort of gradual improvement rather than big leaps forward.
It's a missed marketing opportunity, really, because they should hold back at least and make two a significant update. But you know, that's what they choose.
Right. Let's pick up our final item of. Well, it's not the happiest news, this next one, but it's all right, because we've had three happy pieces of news so far. And that's that Canonical are taking legal action over fake Ubuntu images that have been released. And this is some particularly cloud providers, when you sort of buy a virtual machine for tuppence halfpenny and install Linux on it. A lot of the images on there aren't official images. They're ones that have been sort of hacked together to fix various things or run well in particular circumstances. And a lot of these so-called improvements, really, although in the short term they might be quite good, they don't necessarily have the support behind it. They don't have all the testing and everything else that makes it a proper Ubuntu image. And Canonical have been sort of poking them with a stick and telling them not to do such things. And they are resorting to getting the lawyers out to remove the fake images from the webinet.
Yeah, I think there are two issues here. I read Mark Shuttleworth's post, his blog post on the issue, and he said that he doesn't name who the company is, and he said that they'd been trying to get them to relent for a long time. This isn't like the first instance that they're using lawyers against trying to. Well, it should be perhaps trying to protect their trademark. So I think that's one thing. The other thing is Matthew Garrett, I think, wrote another post responding to Mark's blog post and really, once again, looking for clarification on Canonical and Ubuntu's policy towards its use of trademark within packages. Because I think, you know, to Matthew, that's important, but I think it's a different situation to what Mark was referring to, as in people trying to use pass off Ubuntu, I suppose, to sell their services, and yet actually significantly changing Ubuntu and probably having a bad effect on Ubuntu in the process.
Yeah, I mean, Ubuntu's sort of trademark policy is a bit woolly, to be honest. And I don't necessarily always agree with what they do, but I think this is important. This is actually an issue that I came across quite recently. I was looking to set up just a whole bunch of virtual servers. And there was a test one that had that SSH'd into, and just sort of giving it a poke around, benchmarking it, that sort of thing. And we run all our servers on CentOS because it's a good distro. It's got lots of support. You know, you can sort of rely on it to keep running for a long time. And I just wanted to know which version of CentOS I was running. So I just ran uname, which will tell you, your kernel you're at, and on CentOS it gives you a little like EL5, EL6, EL7. And it came up, it was running kernel 4.5. And I was like, what? the latest version of CentOS runs 3.10. And they'd done exactly the same thing. They'd compiled the latest kernel and stuck it on CentOS. But I've got no idea what security patches are in that. Yeah. I've got no idea whether they're going to release updates for that when other vulnerabilities come out. If something breaks, who do I go to? It's really put me off using that.
I think it is important, and that may put you off Ubuntu. You know, if you thought that was Ubuntu's fault or Canonical's fault or Red Hat's fault. I mean, Red Hat actually, at least Red Hat has a clear policy on its use as a trademark, and people seem to respect it. But I mean, people have to build those packages from source. It's difficult for CentOS and Scientific or whoever it may be.
Yeah, and I think it's a serious issue, because if a kernel vulnerability came out and Ubuntu, you know, Canonical or CentOS said, it's okay, install the latest version and you're safe. You install the latest version, you're not necessarily safe because you don't know what's been used and you could have a gaping vulnerability there. You can dig through and try and find out which versions are vulnerable and what's been done and go to the person who's created it, but how long are they going to take to respond? And can you even get in contact with them?
Yeah.
I mean, it's certainly something I'll be sort of looking into more, and any virtual machines I get, I'll be checking exactly what's going on.
Yeah. So what do you think about Canonical defending its brand, let's say that?
In this case, I think it's absolutely right. If I get a Ubuntu virtual machine, I expect it to have Ubuntu on it, you know, and
yeah.
I expect all the things that Ubuntu promise, you know, support for, is it 5 years? I forget how long
it is. Yeah, it's five.
I expect it to have security patches on, you know, with Canonical, you know, you will get security patches for critical vulnerabilities very quickly. And I expect that. And if I didn't get that, I would be annoyed. And if I found out I didn't get that after I'd had an issue, I would be even more annoyed.
Yeah, especially if you didn't know who to blame.
Yeah.
Mm. I was going to... There's another news story as well. I think Nextcloud 11 is due out today or tomorrow.
Is it? Oh, I missed that one.
Yeah. I think Joss sent me an email. And it looks good. They've focused on security and it does things like add two-factor authentication. It looks really cool. I mean, the project's really coming on. I did try and build the Nextcloud client on Linux, and it requires like 170 meg of dependencies in source code to build, which is a bit of a pain. I went back to the own cloud client, which still works, but you know, they've made huge progress in just those short months. I really, you know, wish them the best. So Nextcloud 11, yeah.
Yeah, so I've never really used Nextcloud because although it seems like a good project, I've never quite had the impetus to upgrade or switch over my own cloud stuff to Nextcloud. And I'm probably quite close to doing it.
Yeah.
It does look that it's getting good and getting sufficiently better than own cloud.
Well, it's like, I might talk about it in the fines, but, you know, it's really straightforward. It's as easy to install as an own cloud update. So.
As an own cloud update?
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't realize that. So you can switch over really easily.
Yeah, you basically keep the content files folder just as you would with an own cloud update and install next, you know, you untar Nextcloud into your web server. Move the files out from own cloud, move them back into the next cloud and run and access it, and it runs the update automatically. Same database, same configuration file.
Yeah. That is tempting then.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just an in place update, really.
Cool. And that, slightly faster than usual, was our news.
Lightning news.
That's good. That's good.
Good news.
Not enough to moan about this week.
Well, it's nearly Christmas. We've got it's been a great year.
The greatest gift that I'll get this year is life. And I'll be grateful for it.
Tonight, thank God it's them instead of me. So it's time for finds of the fortnight. Even though we're recording this on the Tuesday, we just realised the server was down. It was all kind of panic getting the podcast going. I did ask the IRC channel. We've had a few responses. This is... my colours have changed in my terminal. This is James Olympus in bright pink. That's my fault. So this is Abenteuerland. This is weird. abenteuerland.at/smrender is a nice renderer for OpenStreetMap data written in C. Okay.
I can't really hear well because my connection's there, but it sounds like Abenteuer, the German word for adventure.
That sounds like it. That sounds like it, Mike. He's using it to make a set of train spotting maps. That's cool. So it reads data directly from OSM files and XML format and like other tools that require a Postgres server. Okay, so that's good. Don't forget to mention the Pebble debacle. Maybe we should have done that.
They've
downsized, haven't they? I think they've just cut some of their workforce.
Did they go bust or were they absorbed into Fitbit?
So I read an interesting article today. Well, they were running out of money. In fact, the CEO, I can't remember his name, sorry, admitted that firstly, Pebble were at the time, their first watch, wasn't that the biggest Kickstarter in history?
Yeah.
They crowdfunded their kind of fitness watches, but with great battery life, really nice niche stuff. And I think even as last year in 2015, there was rumours that Citizen were tempted to buy them for hundreds of millions of dollars. And then fast forward to earlier this year, I don't know exactly, was it February, they launched the Pebble 2 and a load of other gadgets on Kickstarter. They raise $12 million, I'm doing this from memory. They get thousands of people buying their products. And the CEO today, in an article I read, it might have been on TechCrunch, says that basically they hadn't been profitable apart from in the very early months of their business. I mean, they had moved to like two floors in and a plush office in Palo Alto, so who knows? But the second Kickstarter where they raised $12 million wasn't enough for them to then go out and secure further funding, which is what they needed to survive. And in his words, they really spent all the time since September trying to mitigate the impact for both their customers and for their employees. So yes, they sold their assets and their IP to Fitbit for something like $40 million, which is, you know, probably half of what they were worth in terms of monetary value. But for people who own Pebble, they're now warranty-less. And some of those people have had Pebbles delivered to them from the latest Kickstarter within the last couple of weeks. So it's pretty atrocious, really. It's considering this is one of the highest profile and most successful Kickstarter projects. The fact that so many thousands of people are now going to be burned by the fallout from this is pretty horrible. And obviously we can sympathize to some extent, but you know, this is what we've tried our best to avoid.
Yeah, the thing that really surprises me about this is that there wasn't investors to step in because, they had such a great brand.
I know.
And obviously a lot of loyal customers. But I'm sure they did what they could do.
I should Google it. I don't like referring to him as just the CEO. He said that whereas a few years ago, there were a lot of like venture capitalists funding them, offering to fund them, taking on board what they wanted. And after Kickstarter round two, it was a very different category of people who were willing to invest in them. So kind of family lenders, it sounded like. And it sounds like going to Kickstarter or making Kickstarter kind of part of your business plan and going back to the well to top up your funds is probably a big toxic no entry sign for a lot of those of venture capitalists or the venture funding.
Worked for Oculus.
Yeah. Oculus, I suppose, had a very specific product. I mean, even Fitbit's in trouble, I think. I mean, even Fitbit made a load of people unemployed this year. So I think maybe the bottom, during that period, maybe the bottom has just fallen out of smartwatches and they're really not that interesting.
I think they never became as big as a lot of people expected them to be and so many big players invested in it. So when Pebble came out, they were smartwatches. That was pretty much your only option, or travel back to 1990 and get one of the massive Casios.
Yeah, yeah.
But now, yeah, they're 10 a penny and everyone and their dog's creating them.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry, that turned into a bit of a news article. Tracy C, just today I found Yum-Verify. I'll just put my glasses on, I can't read the terminal. This plugin extends Yum with some commands that give verification information on the installed system, much like RPM-V. It can show all the differences in packages on a CentOS system between when things were installed and now, if any, including some information on the RPM itself will ignore, and it's not installed by default.
That does sound useful.
Yeah, that does sound really, really good. Found this when trying to verify that certain changed files were changed by an automatic update and therefore safe. MacPhail, foodanddrink.scotsman.com/drink/maths-team-works-shortest-route-to-Scotland's-pubs. Oh, yes, that was...
yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, I saw that story when that came up. So this is the travelling salesman. Yeah, this I can't click on the link now, but yeah, that's the shortest route between all the pubs in Glasgow or something, Scotland. If you want a good pub crawl, so you don't have to walk too far for maximum beer bevy efficiency. Go for it, Andrew.
Oh, sorry. Yes, I've got some stuff. So I did some actual journalism.
Ooh.
I know, it's mad, isn't it? But as you'll soon find out, I needn't have bothered. You may remember the Northern Lincolnshire and Google NHS Trust's attack where all electronic devices, I quote, all electronic devices were taken offline by what we assume was a ransomware incident.
Oh, yeah.
I contacted them on the 4th of November. To you know, find out what was all about. Surely, all electronic devices aren't connected to the internet. that would be madness. And surely, all electronic devices aren't all using the same operating system. That would be weird. And all I've got are that this is an ongoing investigation between the Trust, NHS Digital, and the police. And while it continues, we are not in a position to issue any further information. So even fairly innocuous stuff like, you know, what operating systems were you using, how old are they, when were they last patched, stuff like that, they can't tell me. Or maybe they can and just don't want to admit that they're all running macOS, which is why everything's gone up the swanny.
Did you just mention macOS?
Yes, and how great it is for mission critical... an e-statist type equipment.
There are no CVE reports against macOS existent at the moment. There are no known zero-day in the wild vulnerabilities for macOS.
Well, of course there's no known zero days. When you know them, they're no longer zero days.
Yeah, that's true. You got me there, Ben.
Good work. Yes, I've also seen that the Open Rights Group are producing some sort of book to celebrate their 10th anniversary with contributions from Cory Doctorow, Jim Killick, Noel Sharkey, and other people. That looks pretty cool. Unfortunately, our membership lapsed, so we might not get that, but I'll look out for it in all good bookstores. And my third non-free software type discovery is that I've just got into reading Val McDermid novels. She's a crime type person, and she met, before she started writing, she met Jimmy Savile, famous English wrong-un. She met him while she was a reporter and found him so creepy that she based a serial killer on him. And I've just finished reading this book called The Wire in the Blood, in which that serial killer is the antagonist. And so many of the details are exactly the same. So either she's heard about it and not had any evidence to go to the police, or she's gone to the police and been laughed at, or else she's intuited that he's the sort of person that might do these weird things. And it's just so... weird and macabre, so weird.
When was it released?
Early 90s, I think.
Okay, quite a while ago.
Yeah.
When you read it, does that character have Jimmy Savile's face?
Well, he's described as being handsome. so no, but I'm imagining the mannerisms.
Yeah. That does sound creepy.
Them as me finds. It's really mega creepy, super duper creepy.
Shall I go now?
Go for it.
I've been doing a similar thing at two very different scales recently, so I thought I'd use them for my finds. And that's looking in log files, which at a sort of regular level is sort of use grep and less or whatever you want to use, and it's all very innocuous and incredibly boring. But when you actually try and sort of pull data out, you can do it with sort of massive strings of greps and commands and chains and stuff. And it's kind of unwieldy, but it sort of works. If you poke it with a stick hard enough, you can usually find out the information you want. But one of the things I do now is monitor a whole bunch of servers where this doesn't really work. And we pull everything back to a central server using Logstash. And we've actually recently switched from Kibana to Grafana. There's a visualization tool, which is fantastic. You can sort of put everything into big graphs, and it all looks well.
I can imagine Vic Reeves saying those words.
So part of my discovery is that Grafana is just a fantastic tool for visualizing your logs and all that. But it's quite a bit of work to set up. You need, we've got a dedicated server to do it and all that sort of thing. So it's not really that useful for what spent most of my Linux using days doing, that sort of poking around in little log files, which you can do, as I say, with Linux command line tools, but it's often a bit frustrating and a bit awkward. And at that end of the spectrum, I came across, only today actually, a tool called LNav, which basically, it's all wrapped up into one, is a sort of parser of log files, an SQL-like database, and a thingy what's it for navigating and analyzing data. So it doesn't really have any configuration. It just grabs, as long as you've got sort of a standard log format, it just grabs it, pulls it in, and allows you to analyze it much easier than using the sort of text processing tools. I've just found it quite interesting to see two sort of solutions at very different ends of the spectrum. One that we use at sort of data center scale, one that is a sort of thing you'd use on a Raspberry Pi, but still sort of starting with the same raw data. Text log files and poking about.
What was wrong with Kibana? Just out of interest.
Kibana, it works, but it's hard to put my finger on, to be honest. There was stuff that was just awkward to do. There was the styling wasn't, I couldn't get it to look right. There was, hang on, sorry, I've got my head caught on a bike spoke. and while it was just Logstash data, it sort of did what we wanted, but with pulling in collect D, it got really quite awkward with stuff, and even with some of the plugins, we couldn't really get the visualizations we wanted,
right.
And it didn't sort of link together quite as well as we found Grafana does. I've actually still got both running on the same database, and I do still use Kibana for some stuff. I think it's very good for just sort of quickly diving in and finding out what you want to know, and sort of I almost sort of build my queries in Kibana and then put them into Grafana to visualize them.
Right. That sounds cool.
And the second, third, I don't know, my next discovery anyway, is every once in a while we've been having, we do these podcasts over Hangouts. A couple of times I've had real difficulty sort of following along. The connection's been really choppy. I've been dropping in and out. And at least on my end, I'm pretty sure now I've narrowed it down to the washing machine. And that kills my Wi-Fi for reasons I've no idea. I guess the motor must be emitting... Emitting some EM frequency.
That is, it's amazing that... I mean, it's obviously microwaves, but our microwave here just totally destroys everything if the microwave goes on. Despite all that, foolproof shielding.
There's a lot of electricity spinning around in a small space. That's got to do something.
Yeah.
I don't really understand radio waves. But if you're having trouble with your Wi-Fi, try stopping your washing machine. These are my finds.
Thanks, Ben. Shall I do mine? I really should thank GCHQ because I've got all security conscious over the last couple of weeks for some reason. I've been meaning to connect our network to a VPN at the router level for years, And it's taken the Snoopers Charter for me to finally do it. Although I'd love to hear some recommendations of a good VPN that can be trusted, because it's still very unclear. I can't remember the name of the provider, but maybe for the best, but I saw in Reddit Linux this week, one open VPN provider is willing to be, what do you call it? Audited by a security expert. So I can see that kind of endorsement. Somebody, you know, if Bruce Schneier was to endorse a VPN provider, I'd be all over it. And so a little bit late to that, I've used Let's Encrypt as well on my own server. I've been meaning to do this for ages. The thing that held it back was that it's running CentOS 6.7. So for a long time, I couldn't satisfy the Python dependencies to be able to get Let's Encrypt scripts to work. But when I tried it just a couple of weeks ago, it works faultlessly. It's such a brilliant system. I've got it, you know, the same certificate for own cloud, for my email servers, for my email server, for the web, obviously, and I host quite a few websites on there for other people. And it's such a great thing to do. It's such an easy thing to do, and it feels so nice having the little green tick in the browser for your own websites. And even small things like the own cloud, next cloud client on Android, where I needed to forcefully insert my own certificate, which compromised all the security on the phone. You know, I don't have to worry about that anymore. Slightly linked to CentOS 6.7 running on my servers is that it doesn't run, its version of GCC is 4.3. And lots of things need a much later version of GCC than that, especially for the C++ 11 stuff. 4.8 is usually the minimum. And I discovered, my server doesn't have anything critical on it, so I wouldn't do this on like a proper lockdown server. But Scientific Linux built a load of dev tools, including GCC 4.8 for Scientific Linux 6 that you can use in CentOS 6.7. You just import their key, and then you install dev tools set-2. The problem with that is it's like a gig, which if you're running like a cheap low-end box or VPS, you don't want to download a gig worth of data, especially when it includes X. But you can just install GCC from the dev tool set 2 package, well, series of packages. So I got GCC installed that way and got things building with 4.8 perfectly well on CentOS 6.7. I've also been doing so it was the Black Friday sales a couple of weeks ago, and because I'm obviously so security conscious, I thought I should make myself more vulnerable to Amazon. So I bought myself an Amazon Echo. Which is one of these devices that listens to everything you say in the house and sends it to GCHQ, pretending to be this useful device with some kind of AI that you can ask it to play things by One Direction and the Vamps. But Alexa, as it's called, is really, really cool. I don't know if you've ever tried it. I didn't want to go all in with Google. Google offers a very similar device. You basically plug it in. It listens for you to say a keyword. There's a few choice keywords with Alexa, Amazon Echo. It's like Amazon Echo, Alexa, and something like Amazon. You say it, and then you can ask it all kinds of questions. It's not so great with the Google-like queries. I think it defaults to Bing, and you can't ask it deep questions like you can with OK Google, for example. But what I think makes the Amazon Echo pretty good is that it's been around for longer, especially in the US. It's only really recently launched in the UK. And there's quite a few great back ends. In particular, it works with if this, then that.
Does it work with if this and that in the UK?
No. So yes. part of the thing that I've done is I don't use my proper Amazon account for Alexa. I use an account with a US address.
The reason I asked that, actually, is I've been asked to hook Grafana up to an Amazon Echo.
So the if this then that has promised that it's coming really, really soon, and they've known about this release, and they say they're working with Amazon. I suspect that even when it does come, it won't come with as much integration as the US version of if this then that and Alexa.
What is this if this and that you're mentioning, by the way, for those of us out of the loop?
So this is an amazing find, actually, if you've not seen this. I think the best way of describing it is like a simple API for people to use through a web browser. It connects services, and it connects services so that you can do things that not one of the services provides. So, for example, you can connect your Evernote shopping list with your Amazon shopping cart, or you could connect Alexa. Alexa, for example, the Amazon thing, through If This Then That, you link your services up, like the Amazon services, the Alexa services, your home security services, and then they provide a series of kind of cues or recipes that will link to one another, so extending the functionality of them all. So I'm trying to think of a good example, but as I've been playing with this in Amazon Echo, you can say things to Alexa that will email your Gmail account, for example, which won't happen through Amazon. Or
so,
yeah,
the whole idea of it is that you specify the this and the that. So you specify a trigger. So if this happens, then the other one is a
right. But does that mean you have to give the if this and that people access to all these accounts or these services?
Yeah, that's right. You do. You don't have to be authenticated against them all.
I came across one recently, an open source if this and that. It was.
But it's brilliant. I don't use it with any of my main accounts, but it's. So there are things like lots of home automation, for example, lots of Philips Hue lighting hubs, open source software. Now this was going to be one of my finds. So do you remember Philips Hue, the lighting, the remote lighting system, where they locked everybody out of lots of the Chinese manufacturers out from it? It uses a protocol that's been reverse engineered and implemented in open source. And this then becomes the gateway through if this, then that, to automating any open source thing on your home network. So I've connected it to a Raspberry Pi that's running a Philips Hue through some home automation software to be able to do other stuff like change the channel on the television by speaking to Alexa. It goes on and on and on. And this has turned into a monster find section.
There's an open source thing called Trigger Happy at trigger-happy.eu. It has nowhere near as many services that can be linked together as if this then that can, but it's open source and self-hosted.
I mean, I'd definitely look into it. Because yes, it is. I mean, if this and that is a major project, Mike, it's like it's become a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, it's everything. So I've got a thing that just sends me an email in the morning if it's going to rain on my cycle to work.
Yeah, yeah.
And it can be as sort of simple as that, and it can sort of scale up.
And so my and it's been a monster find. It's because I've been kind of automating my home through Alexa. The last one was that I've got this home automation software running on a Raspberry Pi, but I wanted to play music. Alexa, the Amazon Echo, the cheap one I bought the very small one. It comes with a tinny speaker, and while it will play your music, you don't want it to play out of the speaker. You can connect it to a Bluetooth speaker. And I've got an amplifier connected to a Raspberry Pi. So it took me a bit of, and if anybody's interested, I'll share this configuration, but I set up the Raspberry Pi Bluetooth with a cheap USB Bluetooth adapter to operate with Pulse Audio, which takes up 26% of the CPU, I must add, as a Bluetooth source for Alexa and as a sync on the Raspberry Pi so that I can send music directly to my amplifier by asking Alexa to do it through the Raspberry Pi.
I've actually been thinking, I've got a homemade Bluetooth speaker, and it just uses a little circuit board jobby that handles all the Bluetooth, but I've been considering switching it to a Raspberry Pi because then I could have digital radio as well, the same thing. Because I've got a software-defined radio dongle, which I assume will work with the Raspberry Pi.
And that's why I had to use Pulse Audio, is because I've got multiple audio sources on the Raspberry Pi rather. So Pulse Audio means that I can have several things playing at the same time, including Bluetooth audio. And it works. It works absolutely perfectly. It's a bit of a nightmare getting Pulse Audio to work, to be honest. But I've got it up. It's, as soon as it turns on, I can ask that Alexa to connect to the Raspberry Pi and play music that way. And it's just the beginning. I've got all kinds of things that I want to share with GCHQ.
And up until now, you'd managed to keep your niche music interests to yourself.
Well, actually, I've been scrabbling to Last FM for 10 years, so, you know. they're my finds. Sorry.
Is it Christmas yet?
I made up for news then. And have you got
right.
Mike? There's Mike.
Oh, Mike. Yeah, Mike.
I'm still here, even only hearing 50% of the words, but they're great words. They are amazing words. They are like unbelievable.
We have the best.
These words, you're going to love these words.
They're very smart.
Yeah, I found out that Bash, you know, the venerable Bourne shell that we all love and use on our GNU Linux installations, is it has a new logo, which is sort of like a shiny cube, and with like the hash exclamation mark symbol on it, I think. I don't have it in front of me. But what was interesting is that there was a vote to decide the new logo for Bash, and there were 30,000 votes. 30,000 wow. votes for a shell logo.
How many of them were from a hacker named Fortune?
Or the Russian government, yeah, who knows what they're up to now. Despite being an elite Linux journalist, I wasn't even aware that the Bash guys were choosing a new logo. So when they came out with this and said they had 30,000 votes, that's quite impressive. I mean, maybe they're just advertising in entirely different places to what I normally read, but good on them.
I don't know why I feel compelled to point this out, but Bash isn't the Bourne shell. It's the Bourne again.
That's very true, Ben. That's very true. Yeah, the Bourne shell dates back to Unix of 1740 or something. But yeah, the Bourne again shell is the GNU project shell. This is true. Yeah, that's all that I've been able to find in the rest of my hyper-busy life.
Thanks, Mike. And there are finds.
Wow, I'm exhausted, but somehow we'll carry on. Still to come, we may or may not have some neurons to vocalise, but we definitely do have a voice of the masses to neuronalise.
Yes, thanks, Andrew. So, can somebody just remind me before I read out this neuron, did we talk about Comic Sans font in the last podcast?
Yes.
What did we say? I forgot. I'm old. I can't remember these things.
It was that I was on the NHS email debacle where they ended up sending emails for everyone. And a surprising number of people working for the NHS, supposed healthcare professionals, use Comic Sans.
Right. Okay. That's a good link, because I presume we said then in the podcast that Comic Sans should just be used for comics, because I got an email from Kelly Price who says, "Whoa, using Comic Sans to do a comic? Are you nuts? Comic Sans is never appropriate for anything, including comics. They are crap. They break up even on web comics. Chuck the font in the rubbish bin. For comics, even web comics like the one I make, use some better quality fonts. Blambot.com has free fonts that are licensed for non-profit or personal use. And for webcomic authors who release their comic for free but later print the comic, I use these." So, yeah, thanks, Kelly. It took me a moment to work out what you were talking about there, but now I understand the link to the last podcast. So, yeah, don't use Comic Sans even in comics, folks. That's clearly the message here. So, and if there are any other neurons to be vocalized by the masses, then email me, mike@linuxvoice.com.
Right, well, that's great. That brings us to the voice of the masses. Mike asked, what has been good about the last 12 months? Because 2016 is almost over and we will soon be recording what is our last podcast of the year. Just realised we've squandered the opportunity to use the word penultimate last fortnight, and then anti-penultimate the fortnight before that, which is such a waste. I always feel like Stephen Fry when I say the word anti-penultimate.
Is that not like the first?
An anti as in A-N-T-E.
Yeah, as in to up.
As in before, like antebellum.
Yeah, as in to ante up.
Yes, that's the one. Yeah. Sadly, the question and the answers, when I tried to read them, it just says error establishing database connection.
That was a good answer, actually. That is what we're looking forward to most in the next.
It's 9:15, so really that is the best of all possible worlds in this.
Hang on.
Yeah. So I guess we can maybe condense the masses down into just us four for a while Ben fixes the internet.
Well, what was the question? I thought it was about next year.
It was actually, yeah. Andrew said what was good about last year, and I think I mentioned in my multifaceted four dimensions.
I don't want to
in your preamble.
It's just that I don't want to talk about this year. Yeah. I'm done with 2016. Yeah. Let's get the hell out of it.
I think I mentioned that in my question, but I was playing 4D chess as usual, and actually my question was about the future. What are we most looking forward to in 2017? I was going to say 2016, but good heavens.
That's good.
What are we looking forward to? New distro releases, new software releases, Linux getting 3% desktop market share.
Political coups.
That would be mad. 3% desktop share, can you imagine?
Well, yeah. I mean, the sky's the limit.
It's on its way, isn't it? But that... So it's not that, I mean, obviously, I think you're being a bit facetious there because 3% is such a low number, but it's rate of change that's important. There was a really strange episode of Question Time from Wakefield a couple of weeks ago, and it seemed odd because they all seemed quite impassioned about the levels of immigration, and Wakefield has very low levels of immigration. It's only 5% of the population is from outside the UK, but 10 years ago it was 2.5%. So what's actually happened is that the rate of change has exploded. It's 100% change. So if Linux gets to 3% market share on the desktop, that'll be like what, a million bajillion percent increase. Have I done the math?
Yeah,
right?
more or less, I think, yeah.
Percentages there might hard. Be,
it's yeah. hard to know when that's not a word.
Yeah, but I mean, that would be huge when we think that, you know, all the time that we've been Linux journalists, and we were talking about 1.5% on the desktop, and then, you know, it's got up to 2%. Now, 3% would be huge. Yeah, I'm not just joking with that. It would, I mean... Okay, it still seems a tiny number when you think of hundreds of millions of PCs being used, that's millions of people running Linux. So that would be great.
Mm.
I think it's entirely within plausibility that it'll hit 3% fairly soon. It's, you know, it has been increasing steadily for quite a long time now. And yeah, you do talk about small numbers, but as you say, it's a large percentage increase, and it's sustained that rate of growth for quite a while.
And I think there's something is happening here to do with Apple's most recent MacBook Pros. I know it's become a bit of a meme to say, oh, Apple's failed in this, but I'm reading a lot of stuff on Hacker News and Slashdot and Reddit, and so people saying, well, you know, I am a Mac guy because I want a good shiny Unix on decent hardware. I cannot use Windows, it's just horrible. But now I'm looking into the Dell XPS and stuff because I just simply can't buy an insanely expensive new MacBook Pro with a keyboard that feels like you're tapping on sheets of metal. And I think Apple may have really screwed that up there. You know, they had a good chunk of the market there of people who wanted Unix with fewer hassles, so to say. And, you know, Linux is getting shinier and more polished all the time. And you know, that could be a win as well.
Yeah, where I work, most people use Linux, and most people have been using it for less than a year or so.
That's interesting. Mm.
It's all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Right. The masses have rejoined us. Thanks, Ben.
Ben has fixed the server while we've
been
talking.
Ben's fixed the internet.
It's incredible.
Like three times today already.
Man, you're amazing.
He's awesome.
If I fixed it properly the first time, I'd have only had to do it once.
So we have comments from the masses, and Johan says he's looking forward to the year of the Linux desktop. As are we all, of course. Archfoss is looking forward to the year of the Linux mobile phone. Well, that was ages ago. Tom Grigg says, I spy with my little eye some silliness here. Tom Grigg says, now that Microsoft has become a Linux Foundation member, will we see the emergence of a 2017 Microsoft Linux distro? Or does one already exist in a small room that no one talks about in the basement of the Redmond HQ? A Mulder-style L-Files office, if you will. I doubt it, but it is amusing to mull over. I simply look forward to the continued success and ease of use of Mint Cinnamon. Sorry, Ben.
I actually wouldn't be at all surprised if we saw Microsoft Linux next year. It's not good as a desktop OS, but for Azure servers, a specialist Linux build.
Mm. Well, there's a reply to that comment, isn't there? That, and I think we talked about it in one of an earlier podcast, that they do their kind of micro Linux distro for running on their switches.
Yeah, they do.
Ray Woods is looking forward to the rise of LibreOffice and the like for the common man. Wow. If only we had somebody who had the inside track on the old open document malarkey and what they're doing to push LibreOffice for the common man. Do we have anyone?
Who knows, eh? Well, yeah, I mean, it's very similar to the situation with Firefox that, you know, we were saying 10 years ago, or maybe even earlier, the best way to get open source to people is it's hard to get people to switch to Linux, but show them, you know, shiny, practical desktop applications. And I think Firefox was the first really good example of that, you know, a well-polished desktop app that people can use that was genuinely better than the competition. So people went to use it over Internet Explorer because it was better, not just because of, you know, nice, shiny, happy freedom and everything. And I think, yeah, LibreOffice still has some rough edges and things to improve, but it's getting better with every release. And I think that could be something as well. It's an introduction to people to open source. So, yeah, regarding that comment, I think it is sort of, you know, ready for mainstream desktop users.
Great.
Yeah, I think the cloud stuff that LibreOffice have really been pushing in the last sort of 6 months or so could really be quite big,
yeah.
Particularly on the enterprise. I know Microsoft do some things about sort of being able to control your own cloud with Office 360, but compared to what you could do with LibreOffice and just hold it completely in-house and lock down, that's a huge win for a lot of organizations.
Well, yeah, little birds tell me that LibreOffice 5.3, which is due for release at the end of January next year, will include a technical preview of LibreOffice Online. So not maybe 100% ready for everybody to deploy, but you can test it out, put it on a server. Thanks to a lot of work from Collabora, our friend Michael Meeks and his buddies. But it's getting there, yeah. Again, it still has some rough edges, but yeah.
I thought LibreOffice Online was already a thing.
Well, it's a thing in like a super experimental, dig it out of a code repository, maybe mess around with it. It's getting much closer to becoming an actual official part of LibreOffice in that the LibreOffice guys will say, actually, yeah, we recommend using this. At the moment, it's more of a tech demo rather than something practical. The Collabora guys have done a load of work that they're going to put back into LibreOffice 5.3.
Okay.
So, back to the masses. There they are. Espada V8 says, until recently, I was looking forward to big improvements with AMD graphics cards in the mainline kernel. But with the recent mailing list post, it looks like that might be a long way off, if it ever happens at all. AMD cards still seem to be getting much better open source drivers, though, which is nice. Just a shame it looks like it will be an out-of-kernel module. That's to do with games, isn't it? I don't understand these young people today.
This was a thing, basically a bit of a spat between the AMD Linux kernel driver people and the maintainer of that kernel subsystem. where the maintainer said, unless you get your code into, you know, this sort of format all tidied up and polished and properly, it doesn't go in the mainline kernel. AMD driver set, people said, that's great in theory, but we don't have the resources to do that. It's basically this or nothing. And you're just likely to push AMD away from releasing Linux drivers at all if you take that attitude. And both threw their handbags at each other, and that's about where it was when I last saw it. I've got some sympathy with both sides on this, and I don't really know where my where it would fall.
Well, my sympathies are with Chloe Wolfie Girl, who says that the thing that she's most looking forward to in 2017 is getting to hear many more episodes of the Linux Voice podcast. Yes. Along with many other podcasts which are available.
No. It's all wrong.
Excellent. Oh,
poor old Chloe Wolfie Girl there. I don't know. Christian says, the first Linux desktop in my employer's Windows 7 only office in Duisburg, Germany. That's what he's looking forward to. Great work. This is actually, there's quite a good range of variety and stuff here. So Micah Den is looking forward to the sweet release of death after the inevitable fall of humanity.
Cool.
I think that's cool. 2000 and that's 2016 that's happened. Sadly, the old death and fall of humanity. But Justin Fuhrmeister Clark is looking forward to LinuxConf 2017 in Hobart, Australia.
Oh wow, that's I don't want to say isolated place without getting slagged off by loads of Aussies, but it's a pretty isolated place, isn't it?
I went to Cumbria once.
Oh, there be dragons.
Loads of things, quite a few things actually, yeah. The old more games, says Trivia Dave, AAA games, Civ 6 and the like with VR. Somebody else wants to see more VR.
Yeah.
Steve Weaver.
I think VR coming to Linux would be brilliant. This last couple of weeks, Google, HTC and Oculus have created like a global VR association, and I know that Steam VR is getting closer, the Vulkan graphics driver is getting better, the Talos Principle, which is a brilliant game, had a good update this week to improve the speed and performance with Vulkan. All of this bodes well for the state of Linux VR when it appears.
Last final mention should go to Lagamon, who says, I used my Android phone instead of the TomTom on our last holiday trip. We had to due to new roads and an outdated map in the TomTom. TomTom spent the rest of the holiday in the glove compartment. The navigation experience on the Samsung S7 was excellent. Another domain conquered. And somebody else in the thread has mentioned either TomTom or Garmin, and that's long been a bugbear of quite a few people about their sat navs and having to use sync them up with Windows and outdated maps and things. Was it two podcasts ago we were praising OpenStreetMap?
Yeah.
For their excellence. There's a lot to look forward to. But I kind of think that we're doing all right already.
Can I
like
share?
All these things just seem like a continuation of the good stuff that's happening at the moment.
Can I say one thing I'm not looking forward to?
Oh, no.
It's Blade Runner 2049, which is out next year. How can they do that? They're so bereft of ideas. Scripts, directors, actors. Haven't they got anything better to do than... That's all.
It's so great.
I've messed up your microphone as well.
But when they released Phantom Menace, the first rubbish Star Wars, just before they released it, they re-showed all the original Star Wars in the cinema.
Yeah.
So I got to watch all the original trilogy in the cinema, which I wouldn't have been able to do if they hadn't started showing the rubbish ones. So maybe they'll show Blade Runner.
Yeah, and you'll finally get to see it.
The original.
You and I will go and see Blade Runner.
I'll finally get to see it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Okay, yeah, there's a silver lining there.
Maybe. I mean, I sincerely hope that they don't, but remember the Star Wars reissues where they changed the order of of who shot first at the Mos Eisley Cantina. Maybe they'll muck about with Blade Runner like that, but just...
But they've already mucked about with it because Deckard's in it. You know, it's set after Blade Runner and Deckard's in it. So...
No, what I mean is that they'll go back to your cherished childhood memories and desecrate them by making, you know, I don't know, making the owl a human or something.
But I mean, like but the great thing about Blade Runner was the ambiguity, you know, and the fact there wasn't a definitive answer. I know Ridley Scott has said things, but then Harrison Ford had said another thing. And anyway, that I didn't mean it that seriously. I'm glad it'd be good to go to the cinema with Ben and watch Blade Runner. We can't leave the year on something like that, can we? Something good has happened, surely.
What I'm looking forward to is the 8 gallons of cider I currently have fermenting in my kitchen being ready for drinking.
Oh, yeah.
How long left?
Hard to say for sure. Hopefully January. Well, bottling in January and maybe drink in March.
Excellent. I think we should have a party at your house.
That's all good answer. To Ben's house.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For my birthday. So there we go, listeners. That's the takeaway message. We can all look forward to me being 37 and drinking Ben's booze. Hopefully David Bowie won't die again.
Leonard Cohen won't die again.
Prince won't die again. Muhammad Ali.
Prince.
Yeah.
Alan Rickman.
Yeah,
Does Muhammad Ali die?
Muhammad Ali died this year, yeah. I know.
Terry Wogan.
I only found out like last week that Lemmy died.
Yeah. that was the first. He was the harbinger. Yeah.
He opened the floodgates.
Oh. It was his fault. whatever pact he made at the gates to St. Paul.
Right, so all of those people, please don't die. And we'll be back next year.
Yes.
With more of this sort of gibberish. And until then, we really do wish you a very happy Christmas. And it'd be great if you tune in and listen to us again in the new year. Thanks. Bye, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Happy Christmas. It's such a nice day.